Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the War Report. And for those of you who are new to our show, we welcome you as well. Today, we have Dr. Lori Martin, whose new book is called The Big Box Schools, Race, Education, and the Danger of Walmartization of Public Education in America. That's going to be the center of our conversation. We also have a return for, I don't know how many times this guy has been on the show. I got to go back and look this up. But Dr. Mark Nason is on again. So we have a full house. Let me get right to it. And welcome, Dr. Lori Martin. Welcome,
Thank
Lori.
You. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mark, I'm sort of trying to decide whether or not I should welcome you back or not. I'll determine that as we go through the show.
You don't have to welcome me.
Okay. All right. So, now, Lori, your resume, what people know as resume, we call curriculum vitae, is so extensive that I decided I would not try and cover it on air because we don't have enough time. Your resume alone is a 2-hour show. So do us a favor and give us the highlight and a small, short bio of Lori.
Sure. Again, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Lori, one more point.
Yes.
Folks, Dr. Martin here, when we called her today, she's very formal with me. I'm hoping by the time the show is over, she will move off the Dr. Miller crap to, hey, man, what do you think about this? We'll see.
Lori is a minister's daughter.
That explains everything. Okay, so I now have to watch my language. I have to watch my language. Whoa, didn't know that, Lori. I would have not probably invited you. But anyway, go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm originally from Nyack, New York. I was born and raised in South Nyack, New York. A lot of people don't know where exactly that is, but it's about 30 miles north of New York City. I graduated from the Nyack Public Schools. I'm a proud product of the Nyack Public School system. After graduating from high school, I went to Fordham University, where a great classmate, Victoria Thomas, suggested that I take a course taught by Mark Nason. So it's really an honor to be on the same call with him. And then he introduced me to the Center for Urban Studies in Buffalo, where I received my master's. And then after working for about a year in the field of HIV and AIDS, I decided to get the PhD, which I did at SUNY Albany. And then I worked at some universities and colleges in the Capital Region area of New York before joining the City of New York university system, and then I accepted a position at Louisiana State University in sociology with a joint appointment in African and African American studies. And so now I'm living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Well, with coffee and a hamburger.
Now, it is that latter part that really, really got me. Folks, she is a fellow sociologist and black study professor.
Right.
Does that sound familiar? Sound familiar to you people? She and I are birds of the same feather, or birds of the same flock, or whatever, however that goes. Mark is also black studies. We have a conference going on here, folks. This is going to be so cool for me. to be able to talk with people from my discipline, my specialties, and at a level that I don't get a chance to do ever anymore. So let's get to it. Oh, Mark, do the intro for yourself, but people know you already, but I want to know.
Okay, I'm a professor of African-American studies and history at Fordham University. I run a large community research project called the Bronx African-American History Project, and I've been very involved in education issues ever since the community history projects that I was running in Bronx schools were pushed out by an obsession with testing and teacher and school evaluation. So I'm a historian by training. My specialty is Black studies, but I am for taking the historical work that we have done and making it something which energizes and empowers people at the public school level and the community level. So that's me.
Okay, so you're trying to move from history is dead to history is alive and active.
Exactly.
Okay, so when you and I were in school, it was always history was a dead subject. So, but anyway, now, your book, Lori,
yes,
that's going to be our centerpiece, but I think your background that has made you the person that you are, mm-hmm, is so much reflected into, I think, and I'm going to put myself on a limb here, in your book. And the reason I say that is as I was reading your book, there were so many passages that I wrote a note on. This was me in 19 so-and-so. This was me in 19 so-and-so. This mm-hmm was me at so-and-so and so-and-so. I could identify with so much of your book that it made me think that a lot of your own background may be reflected in the book and how you approached it. Am I anywhere close?
I would say that that's accurate, especially since one of the main reasons or one of the driving forces behind the creation of this book was my own experiences trying to enroll my two sons, who are now 15 and 5, into public schools in the East Baton Rouge Parish. And so it was that experience that really, you know, made me want to learn more about what was happening in the public school system, to explore from an academic perspective what was happening and how, you know, the different trends that I was observing was manifesting itself in the lives of other people, not just in the school district I was dealing with or in the state of Louisiana, but in the nation as a whole.
So I was correct in that, that we also, in addition to being sociologists, Black studies, our parents, and et cetera, public school
right
kids, ourselves, we got the whole package going between us.
Right.
Now,
right,
the book. I positioned the book in terms of promoting your coming on the show as presenting, asking the question whether or not it, the Walmartization presents a clear and present danger to public education. You pretty much in your title says that the danger of the Walmartization of public schools in America. I just turned that into a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that this is a phenomena that does impose a very clear and present danger to public education today and its future?
Absolutely, and I think that that is the case not only in inner city communities, although my focus, as you know, having read the book, is on the impact of communities of color and students of color, because I do believe that they will be the most impacted by it. But yeah, we're also seeing it, though, in suburban areas. We're also seeing it throughout the country. So, yeah, so without a doubt, my answer is absolutely. There is a serious and present danger of the Walmartization towards public schools in America today.
In picking that title, because mm-hmm I'm one of those people who believe that a great title tells me what the book's about before I even open a cover to the book.
Right.
And so in picking your title, how did you arrive at it?
That's a great question. So in Baton Rouge, where I live, there were already two Walmart supercenters, and a third one was recently built near where I live. So I was driving by it several times and noted on one particular day that they had a community health fair. My husband pointed it out and, you know, thought it was such a wonderful thing that they're having this health fair at Walmart. And I said, you know, that reminds me back in the day when you'd have people who maybe were drug dealers or involved in some other area of the underground economy would maybe give out turkeys on Thanksgiving or do something on a particular day to show support for the community. But, you know, throughout the year, they were, in fact, poisoning the community. And so I was thinking that, you know, this is what's happening with Walmart, that, you know, people are thinking, oh, this is fabulous. I can buy products at low prices, and this is just so wonderful, without really looking at the impact it was having on small businesses, wages, et cetera. So, you know, as I started thinking through this idea about, well, what does it mean to Walmartize, to have this process of Walmartization take place in the U.S. as it relates to public schools, it became even clearer to me looking at the role of wealthy elites and what they have been able to accomplish in a relatively short period of time, that this was clearly taking place in the American public schools. And so I started reading about Sam Walton and his 10 tips for success, but identified a hidden curriculum that I felt that wealthy elites were using and applying under the guise of reforming American public schools.
That is excellent, because that's exactly what I had come to conclude some time ago. And again, puts us on the same page about something about giving, having this health fair, and you mentioned how drug dealers and other nefarious people would give turkeys and et cetera for Thanksgiving and Christmas. Am I right, Mark? That was also something that criminal organizations throughout history would do. I was thinking of the mafia.
I grew up in a mafia-dominated neighborhood, and when I was moved from third to fourth grade in the middle of the year by my excessively ambitious parents, I came into a situation where the tough Italian kids were taking a nickel a week protection money from any kid in the class who wouldn't fight them. And at the end of the month, each month, they would take all the kids under their protection and buy them Italian bread with sauerkraut and mustard as a present. So after taking protection money, they would then have this little celebration. So I think there is exactly something to that. You know, you exploit people, and wasn't the same thing done on the plantations with these huge festivals that they have?
Yeah.
Like Roger Abrahams wrote a book about it. You know, these corn shucking festivals, you know. So I think that what you know, Dr. Martin is saying is really important, to not be deceived.
Mark,
by
you
that.
Just caused me to remember something that takes me back almost 60 years almost. When I was 10, we moved into an all-white neighborhood. I was the only black kid on the block. Most of the kids and families were Italian, going to the Catholic school.
Mm-hmm.
There's one kid who was a little older. Not that little. He was little. He was maybe several years older. He had a paper route. People who don't know what a paper route is, that's when we boys used to deliver your paper from their bikes, from walking, throwing your paper up on your porch and what have you. And this guy had a route where he delivered papers at night. Well, once the kids started talking to me and recognized me as being a human being and part of the neighborhood, he approached me and he asked me to help him throw his papers at night.
Mm.
And after we would do it, he would treat me to a loaf of Italian bread and a Pepsi.
Wow.
That was my reward. I was working for I don't know how many hours throwing these papers. They were heavy. I was a little kid, but my reward was we're going to get some hot Italian bread and a Pepsi. So, Lori, as I told you, your book resonates quite
yeah.
deeply with me.
Great.
Now, you talk about, and what I wanted to go from that original question was, okay, how is Walmart such a danger?
Right, so there's
you
a lot of...
You enumerate in your book many things, but mm-hmm. let's start with the Walmart business model that you mm-hmm. described.
Yeah, so if you take a look at the biography or the autobiography that Sam Walton wrote, he identifies 10 rules for success for any, you know, startup business. And he talks about things like commitment, that you really have to be dedicated, that you should show appreciation to people who are working with you, that you want to listen to those folks, and you want to exceed customers' expectations. You also want to do what no one else is doing. And, you know, those types of things are, you know, things that might benefit any small business owner, any CEO. But what I found and what I argue in the book is that there is also this hidden curriculum. So we in American society have seen this, unfortunately, time and time again, that there are a set of values that we say that we believe and that we adhere to, and then we act in ways that don't necessarily support those particular values. And so in terms of looking at Walmart and its hidden curriculum, one thing, for example, that we learn or that corporate elites who are involved in educational reform efforts have learned is that there's never a bad time to benefit. So Walmart has been successful in still raking in the dollars, whether we're in good economic times or bad. And we see the same thing with regards to the corporate elite. Another thing that Walmart has been successful in doing is eliminating true choice. So that if you look at some of the research, it shows that people in the South, for example, go to Walmart than anywhere else, are more likely to go to Walmart than people living in other regions. And it's not because they really feel necessarily that Walmart provides them with greater service and they love, you know, the fact that there are greeters there, but Walmart has been successful in eliminating true choice so that there aren't a lot of options. Most Americans, in fact, live within like 15 miles of a Walmart and spend about 25 cents of every dollar at a Walmart grocery store. Walmart has also been successful in terms of their messaging. So they're telling people this idea that they can save more and that they can live better. We know that their workers are oftentimes depending upon public assistance, that they discriminate against their workers, especially the female workers. And then similarly, if you look at these big box schools or what I've called pop-up schools, like your magnet schools and your charter schools, they've recognized that messaging is key. So they use terms like free, they use terms like choice, you know, so that they're terms that parents who have been calling for changes and for educational reform forever will identify with. And so these are just some of the things that I think that Walmart has been successful doing in the corporate world that corporate elites have adopted and are applying to the public school system. And then just another thing, too, is controlling the media and controlling the message and elected officials. And so Walmart, you'll find, doesn't necessarily advertise with local media outlets, but they advertise nationally, and they have been successful in working with many individuals in positions of power. We see this not only with large corporations like Walmart, but think about Bill and Melinda Gates and the Gates Foundation. So they have their hands in a lot of different places and a lot of different pots, and they're able to influence not only the media, but the electoral process and public policy. And that's what's really dangerous about this business model and its adaptation to American public schools.
In your research,
I want to kick in. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Mark.
No, you go ahead, James. I'll hold
on. I was just going to say, Lori, in your research, did you ever come across J. Paul Getty? I remember when I left teaching and I decided that I would go into the business world. I went and worked on an MBA in accounting and taxation and banking, and I went to law school. And I ran across J. Paul Getty. And he said his success that made him probably the wealthiest person in the U.S. at that particular time was that you build it bigger, cheaper, and sell it for less than your competition, which means you have no competition if you can do those three things, and you will dominate. I hear that in what you just said about Walmart, about Sam Walmart.
Yeah, and definitely, and I know that Mark is just coming from a wonderful conference, and I hope this will be a nice segue for him to talk about that. But just a couple other things in this hidden curriculum is that Walmart has been successful in creating this illusion of a culture of cooperation, so referring to employees as associates and acting as though they have a say and an important role in everything that happens when we, again, have evidence that that's not the case. Also, with Walmart and other big school, big box models, the idea that prior experience is not necessary is we're seeing that all over the place with a lot of these national charter schools, for example, where the people who are running them are coming right out of the business world. They're not educators. They're not people who have spent years in a classroom and have an understanding of what it's like and what the needs are. And then finally, Walmart and other big box stores and the corporate America has been very good at including and excluding people without apology. And we have that same thing happening with regards to magnet schools and trying to get my son, for example, into school in kindergarten, to put a number on a child who's 5 years old and then have them go through an assessment that you're not even quite sure what it's for, and then to have them deal with that and then have to worry about whether or not they're going to be accepted or not, or to have your child enrolled in a magnet school, such as my oldest son, whereby at any moment, if he doesn't maintain a particular GPA, that he can be put out and, as I describe it, sentenced to the so-called failing school in a neighborhood. And so on the one hand, you're trying to motivate children who might be in a magnet school or a charter school, but at the same time, the tools that you're using to motivate them are continuing to vilify students who did not have the benefit of going to those particular programs. When what we should be doing is strengthening all public schools.
Mark, I mean, I want to kick in here. One of the things that Lori said, and you also said in talking about Jay Paul Getty, in this business model is destroying the competition. And the charter school movement has followed that to a T. Initially, the idea of charter schools would be they would create models which would improve public schools. But in the last 15 years, the charter school movement has systematically tried to weaken and undermine public schools to give them greater access to funding and political support. There isn't a city in the country where the charter school community doesn't attack and try to undermine and take funding away from public schools. So, and you basically are trying to eliminate real choice between public schools and charter schools. And there's a rationale behind that which is rarely understood. In New York City, there's a hiring freeze in the public schools. When it was taken off for 6 months, there was a huge exodus of charter school teachers to the public schools because those teachers wanted union protection and the opportunity to be treated with respect. The Walmart model is intimidation of employees, stifling of their efforts to have any kind of autonomy, and lowering their wages to the nth degree. Walmart CEO makes $16,000 an hour. The associate starts at $7 an hour. And you see this model spreading to charter schools, who increasingly have high-paid CEOs instead of principals. So what Dr. Martin is talking about, that business model has spread to charter schools and is being used to undermine public schools.
Mark, just something that you said that I would like you to maybe add a little bit to it, and that is charter schools, the idea, the current model of charter school started there in New York with a union president whose idea was that charter schools would be sort of a part of public schools, and the charter schools would be the place where, like, John Dewey School in Chicago,
right,
be experimental, innovative, and would develop curriculum, pedagogy that would be so outstanding because they were free to experiment in good, on a good way, that the results of those experiments could then be exported to the public schools.
Exactly. That was the original model.
That was the original concept.
Now,
that started there in New York.
What has happened is that business elites who have seen opportunities for investment dry up in other markets have decided that public education is a huge market for profit-making investment, and decided to use the charter school movement to open public education to privatization. And in the process, you know, giving them access to a market which allows them to make profits both directly and indirectly. So the charter
right.
school movement has essentially been taken over by business elites.
And you know from knowing me that I've talked about that particular aspect of it maybe a million times on air, the fact that there are estimates that says that from K through 12, it could be somewhere close to a $700 billion market. And when you throw
yep.
in up to PhD, that number goes to $1.2 to $1.5 trillion in the U.S. And globally, you throw in from pre-K to PhD, it's estimated to be $7 trillion. Now, we do
no.
have a caller. Go ahead, Mark. Finish off. Then we'll go to our caller.
No, but what you know, Dr. Martin's experiences with her children is her children only count as data points. They don't count as persons. And that's the consequence of this business model, is that children become data points.
Like InBloom, 600 point data point that InBloom was trying to standardize across the country.
Yes. So
let's
me
go
leave this to the caller.
Okay. Caller, would you bring our caller on, Alice from New York?
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. I've enjoyed the conversation. I have a question with regard to what was mentioned. Indirect and direct profits of the charter school movement. And I know if Dr. Martin can elaborate on that. How is money made by the charter school system?
Well, there's an investment tax credit of 39% that a year that allows you to get your return back if you invest in a charter school within 7 years and then make huge profits. So that's one thing. There's the U.S. government actually gives a huge tax credit for investments in charter schools. So that's one thing. The other is the curriculum that is developed is highly standardized and, you know, creates profit opportunities for test companies. So, some of the charter schools also are, in fact, privately owned. There are charter schools which are public, and there are charter schools which are private enterprises. So between the tax credit, the curriculum, and the testing, and then the privately managed charter schools, there's a lot of opportunities.
Let me
I would add
something.
To that. Go ahead.
You go ahead.
And I was just going to say, too, and if you look at some of the literature concerning the Obama administration's race to the top, some of the funding under that particular initiative also would go to states who would develop or restructure plans that would open up opportunities for the establishment of more charter schools. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is that just so that we don't get stuck on charter schools, because I talk about pop-up schools in general to include any alternative to what we might think about in terms of traditional schools, and to put it in a larger context, I also mentioned that this is big business in terms of the privatization of public schools, but we also need to recognize that it's linked to other institutions. So people who are benefiting from the privatization of public schools are also some of the same folks, indirectly or directly, who are benefiting from the privatization of prisons. And so I talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, which, despite what some might argue, is a very real concept that I address in the book as well.
And also,
yes,
let me add that there are incentives that the government provides, low-cost loans. There are real estate deals that are subsidized.
Yes.
Mark, I was expecting you to say that because you and I are both going to talk about gentrification and the role of education in that process. Now, we're going
to
talk about that in our own show later on, but that's just another one of the vehicles of which investors are attracted to in becoming investors in public education is because there are just so many avenues that you can get a profit from that, I mean, we're talking skyrocketing profit, and also how schools, how charter schools are managed, operated. You can pay your staff very low wages like the Walmart and your CEOs big money, but you can also have a profit margin for those that are for-profit organizations. You can also have ways of contracting out to supposedly independent vendors for services that may also have a direct tie to members who own or who operate the charter schools, and giving them very lucrative contracts. There is a chain that have many links in it, and how you can profit from or pull money out of charter schools that are supposedly are public schools, but they're public schools in terms of getting public dollars. They are private schools when it comes to defending themselves in court. And I can go on and on and on. I'm going to do a 2-4-part series this summer on charter schools. Alice, did we answer your question?
Yes, you did. Thank you. I do have another quick question. What can parents do who are in the public school system to try to either push back on this corporate takeover of the public schools?
I'm going to let you take it, Lori, because I have already put out a solution several times that people hate me about, but I'll say it once you're finished.
Oh, no. I only heard part of the question. I believe the caller asked about what parents can do in the effort to try to push back against this particular movement. And I would say that there are a number of strategies that have been set forth. There was a wonderful piece that appeared in the Journal News in Rockland County, where the author basically described the fact that for Black families in particular, that many are opting out of the system altogether, and so many are exploring homeschooling, which some people have seen as an option. And so that's something that we're already seeing people doing. There are also a lot of grassroots organizations, such as one that I talk about in my book called Our Schools Are Excellent, which is an initiative of Metromorphosis, and their motto is one that I really love and continue to share with others, and that is that every child deserves an excellent education. And so not only do they make sure that young people have a voice and that there's community engagement, but they also have parents that are actively involved, and parents are sharing information and shedding light on what their children are experiencing and what's happening nationally, and developing strategies to make sure that parents are engaged and parents are aware. And whenever the local school district is having some sessions where they want to know what parents think, they're there. They're mobilizing individuals so that the school districts and elected officials can't say they haven't heard from the people. So the parents are really taking control, and I would encourage even more parents to do that. So there are a number of different strategies, but it's really mobilizing parents in conjunction with making sure that young people have a voice and keeping communities engaged is really critical to addressing the trends that we're observing in public schools in America.
You want to hear my solution?
Sure.
I have said that on any given Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, if all the black parents and the Hispanic parents kept their kids home, the charter school, the privatization movement would collapse by the end of the day, because it is the minorities, as Lori talks about in her book, who I argue were the primary targets of this privatization movement. They made it such that we bought it hook, line, and sinker. If we were to boycott, the industry would collapse. That's my solution. But we have another caller. You want to finish? Because we have another caller from Hawaii.
I was just going to say quickly that I think that that's an interesting solution. The one challenge, though, is that one of the things that's attracted parents of color, students of color, is that they don't necessarily see an alternative. And so just to have a boycott without making sure that there have been some structural transformations in the existing public school system, may present a challenge. And so one of the reasons why I think these alternatives and this mythical school choice has been successful is that parents of color and other parents believe that they suddenly have an option, whereas in the past, people who could afford to move to more affluent neighborhoods, people could afford to send their kids to private schools, parochial schools, they had choices, but people of color, blacks in the working class, for example, didn't really have a choice. And so these alternatives are, marketed as being a choice. And so we can't just say to black and Latino parents, parents of color, just don't send your kids to school today. We need to be able to say, because this is what the public school system is going, to look like. And so we have to be honest about the challenges that public schools face, and we don't want to have angels versus villains. We recognize that it's very complex, but I think we have to have a multi-pronged approach to dealing with the issue and developing
solutions. I understand your position. Boycott the schools tomorrow. We'll deal with the alternative. You keep how many millions of kids out of school? Politicians and et cetera will race to get an alternative that is acceptable, and we define what is acceptable. But anyway, that's a whole other argument. We do have another caller. So, Alice, I hope we answered your questions. We're going to go to the caller from Hawaii, if she's still there. And then, Lori, we're going to come back and go to another part of your book that I think is really super fascinating.
Great.
So is that caller from Hawaii there?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello,
you are?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, and you are?
My name's Marae Ellsworth. I'm an activist out here in Hawaii. And we have had a recent development of our associate superintendent just got appointed as a deputy assistant secretary for the U.S. Department of Education Office of Elementary and Secondary Education. And my fear, and I just wanted to get a comment because of the expertise on your panel today, my fear is that this is an open invitation for the U.S. Department of Education to plan for a Hurricane Katrina-type takeover of our entire system here in the state, since we are all one giant school district. Because if we have somebody over there who knows the system inside and out, it seems like an easy, clean sweep to privatize. And I just want to know what activists on the ground can do about that, and if this really is a clear and present danger, or if I am over-exaggerating.
I'm familiar with what's going on there in Hawaii, and I think you do have reason for concern. I think because, well, for one thing, you just had, in one of your areas, you had a union election where the union that was in power lost power but refused to give up power in order to continue to be able to, and I think, collaborate with the powers to be in order to keep the system the way it is, and that is moving everything towards privatization. I think you have an issue there, a very important issue, but I also think that by you raising this question, you see the bigger picture and the concerns that emanate from seeing that bigger picture. Mark, you were going to say something. Let's make this brief because we're beginning to run out of time.
I think you have to mobilize very aggressively against the possibility of a federal takeover. We had a situation like this at my own university where the U.S. Department of Education was trying to dictate assessments of each individual class according to a cookie-cutter formula, and they were threatening to deny funds to our university if we didn't do that. And across the board, our faculty simply refused to do it. We said, it's a violation of academic freedom. We're not doing it. And they backed off. I think if you see the danger, you've got to start reaching out to people and said, what little vestige of professional autonomy you have is in danger. If you want to be able to keep doing your jobs, you've got to fight this and organize against it proactively.
And the parents, and especially your high school students. That's where your coalition is, your alliance, and that's where your numbers are. Teachers alone won't be a big enough threat, but if you coalesce...
Exactly. Parents and students with teachers.
You will be able to stop this person's influence dead in its track.
I would love to hear from Lori.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with what has been said, especially when it comes to mobilizing. I think one of the challenges that we all have as leaders, whether it's on education or on some other topic, is to be able to allow for others to really feel the pain of people who are being most directly affected. We need to make people aware that what's happening in public schools, even if their child is in a private school, even if their child is already graduated, that this is meaningful for us as a nation, as a society going forward. So, you know, while all the people who are on the call and many of the people who are listening are recognizing the danger, we have a lot of work to do so that other people will see the danger and they'll be willing to, you know, mobilize and to bring about change.
Okay. I mean, ultimately, these changes turn children into data points, not human beings with complex aptitudes, needs, emotional, you know, structures. And this is going to be devastating to children. And that's the point at which people will fight.
Well, we need to do it now. We need to do it sooner than later.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for your insight. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
But really,
good luck.
Your question pivot us to where I want to go next with the time that we have left. Lori, for those who have not seen your book yet or have not gone to look up what your book is all about, it's really a very complex book and a short number of pages. You talk about race, you talk about class, which we haven't really mentioned here yet in any great detail, focused detail. And that's what you really were looking at, was how when you Walmart, when you take a public education system and you turn it into a Walmart-type business model, the people who are impacted negatively the most are your people of color.
Yes, exactly.
Now, that was the salient point that I think you were trying to... I know there were many other points, but to me that was one of the most mm-hmm. salient points. And then also, for me, it was my thing, and that is, I'm so anti-privatization of everything and everyone. You had a lot to say about that. But in the end, what I really enjoy, and there was many things, and I said, I think you and I are going to have to do this talk and this conversation again to do more justice to your book. But in the end, your last chapter, you actually identified the role that each of the participants in the education process has to play to make this thing better and to make it work. I truly appreciated that last chapter because it's not often that we look at the entire population and identify the role that each has to play in order to get to a better place for public education. We have a lot of blame game, which is a subject of another show that I plan to do this summer, the blame game. But you do something that when I was coming through as a sociologist didn't do. You ventured off into social policy. You ventured off to social policy. You moved from an academic scientist to a policy expert. Let's talk about some of the policies that you are advocating in this last chapter as you identify the roles that others should be playing in this game.
Yeah, so in looking at the last two chapters, I would say, are critically important because what I learned in terms of, you know, moving beyond, as we must do as scholars from my own personal experience, to analyzing the data and talking to other folks, was that there are
other
some
scholars,
good models out.
Other scholars. We talk to other scholars.
Yeah, so what, you know, what must be done. And so in profiling groups like Our Schools, Our Excellence, and looking at what they were doing and how they were making sure, as I mentioned previously, that young people had a voice, that parents had a voice, that communities were engaged, and those things were critical. And that looking at education was not just the end in and of itself, but it had to be part of a larger plan that also looked at the development of distressed neighborhoods and the surrounding communities, as they're doing with the Future Academy in Buffalo, and how in their efforts to do that, they're trying to restore the school, the neighborhood school, as the hub of the community. And again, taking into consideration not just what was happening academically, but looking at the school as being an important component of the community. And then the organization that Mark helped to establish, referred to as BATS, how teachers are mobilizing and what teachers were pushing back on in terms of this effort to privatize public education and how critical those things were. And so it was from learning from what they were doing, which inspired me to then ask some of the educators, what did they think was necessary towards moving forward, and to think about it more carefully myself, and to focus on issues, things that we don't oftentimes don't even think about in terms of what Mark was saying about how, you know, the children are hurt. I'm thinking about even in terms of, like, issues of transportation. And we're not talking about just in rural communities. We're talking about in urban communities where high school students are asked to be waiting for a bus at 5 a.m. to take them to a school that may be more than 10 miles away from their neighborhood and might put them at risk from a number of sources. And that's not something that would be tolerated if it were happening to someone else's child. And recognizing, too, that while, you know, many would argue that education is the key and that it leads to upward mobility, that race still matters, that even people that have PhDs, if you have someone that's black with a PhD, someone that's white with a PhD, they don't necessarily have the same earning power. They don't have the same return on investment. And so we have to, you know, have a real conversation about this myth of living in a post-racial society. And again, looking at who benefits and knowing that it's not just about the educational system, but as I mentioned previously, the school-to-prison pipeline is real. And so when kids are, you know, being set up to be part of a system that is going to lead to incarceration when they're in preschool, that's something that we should all be concerned about and that we should all work to try and change the course.
Yes.
I'm going to have to leave out for the family issues here in the car. So thank you so much, Dr. Miller.
Okay.
Amazing. Glad to
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mark. Okay. Lori, what I wanted us to be able to get to, and we're going to run out of time, is in that last chapter, you talk about the roles that different players should play. You talk about the role of the business community. You talk mm-hmm. about the role of legislatures and parents mm-hmm. and educators. Mm-hmm. Even, mm-hmm. you don't mention it per se, but also I would add the role of the student. What they should play. Mm-hmm. You did mention mm-hmm. the transportation issues, but mm-hmm. then you break the community down in terms of the black or people of color communities, mm-hmm. white communities. All of these are players that mm-hmm. people don't usually identify and discuss, and particularly in the role. Mm-hmm. Business communities certainly don't, because you know the parents are the ones who send the kids to the privatized schools or the takeover or turnaround schools. They need those kids there for the $10,000 to $20,000 that each child mm-hmm. represents. So mm-hmm. they don't talk about the parents. They don't talk about the kids. They only talk about the school as being bad or mm-hmm. neighborhoods being problematic and et cetera. But you go further than that. And I appreciate that very much.
Thank you. One more comment from me.
Is that it all boils down to the very first show that I did. We've been on air now 15 months. The first two shows, I talked about when everything is said and done, it is the purpose of education that is the real issue. And he mm-hmm. or she who controls, who defines that purpose and has the vision for that purpose, is the one who is going to control the nature of, define and the nature of public education in America. You do that very well. And that was another thing that I appreciated so much, is your recognition of having to deal with the purpose. We have lost our way. Or we, another way of putting it is that the purpose of education being the socialization purpose versus the training purpose of providing bodies for business now and in the future. Major, to me, major, major point that should never be forgotten in any conversation about education, and that is, what is the purpose of education, and that the people who are involved, people who are affected by it, should play a role in defining that purpose. Lori, we have 30 seconds. Take us out with your last comment.
Yeah, again, thank you very much for having me. You're exactly right in terms of looking at who controls the conversation and that we should see education not as a form exclusively of workforce development, but as a power revolutionary tool, and that there's something that everyone can do. So parents can support their kids academically. Community-based organizations can fill in the gap whenever there's a need, and that we should demand more of the businesses where we spend our dollars.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time, and as usual, we did not cover probably half of the things that I wanted to have as part of this conversation. And I'm going to invite our guest back to talk about the study that she did. It's amazing results, and so there's so much to do. So with that, I'm going to have to say goodbye before I get in trouble once again, and hopefully you learned something, you got something of importance here, and that you'll be back next week. Have a good Sunday afternoon, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.